bad spot as far as Christmas went. Christmas and I were bitter toward one another. I brought this up to show you my Christmas spirit. I made my own gingerbread house. Thank you. Thank you. I actually worked hard at it. You know, I've got the roof. I've got a chimney. You might not be able to see it. I somehow have got a greenhouse to take place on the ridge. I've got trees, and my dad made this Christmas tree. I got coconut for snow, and on my very own, I thought of using coffee beans for a walkway. So I just thought I would come and show you all this, that maybe there's a little bit more Christmas spirit in Jay than normal. Because, yeah, I think that there might be this year. I don't know. I'll talk to you in a little bit about it. I'm going to put this behind this table so that everyone's not looking at my Christmas house. It would be sort of like if we were to hang a Rembrandt in here. Nobody could take their eyes off it. Sort of on the same level, you know. All right. Couple of things to make everybody aware of. The first one is we do have a Christmas Eve service tonight. It's our candlelight service. That's at 7 o'clock right here. All right, so 7 o'clock tonight. It's a great time for family and whatnot. Bring your kids. We're going to have, like, coloring stations set up in the corners and stuff. So if your kids need something to keep them busy, they'll have that, you know. So it's a family time. A lot of singing tonight, a lot of carols, you know. If you like carols, this is your kind of a thing. We'll do them cornerstone. We'll throw some cornerstone-y stuff in there. So that'll be fun. But yeah, tonight's going to be very cool. In 2 weeks, we have Vision Sunday, which is my favorite day of the year from a ministry standpoint. So plan on making sure you have January 7th down as a priority. Next week, I'm just giving you this warning right up front, okay? When you come next week, you got to be ready for anything, okay? Next slide, please. And so I know that there's probably a lot of family and stuff that maybe don't come regularly because today's Christmas Eve and whatnot. We want to say welcome to you. If this is your first time with us, you can fill out one of those blue cards on the back of the chairs in front of you. If you could fill out one of those and stick it in a joy box on your way out, that would be cool. Thank you. Well done. That would be great. So welcome. Welcome to Cornerstone. My name's Jay. I'm one of the pastors here, so it's great to have you with us if this is your first time. We've been studying the book of John for a while now, and it was amazing how God lined up Christmas Eve with right where we're at in the book of John. I mean, we're not going to skip a beat. We're going to continue in John, and it's going to be Christmassy, sort of. You'll see what I mean. Let me read John 12 to you. It says this. 6 days before the Passover ceremonies began, Jesus arrived in Bethany, the home of Lazarus, the man he had raised from the dead. A dinner was prepared in Jesus' honor. Martha served, and Lazarus sat at the table with him. Then Mary took a 12-ounce jar of expensive perfume made from essence of nard, and she anointed Jesus' feet with it and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with fragrance. But Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, the one who would betray him, said, "That perfume was worth a small fortune. It should have been sold and the money given to the poor." Not that he cared for the poor. He was a thief who was in charge of the disciples' funds, and he often took some for his own use. Jesus replied, "Leave her alone. She did it in preparation for my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but I will not be here with you much longer." When all the people heard of Jesus' arrival, they flocked to see him and also to see Lazarus, the man Jesus had raised from the dead. Then the leading priest decided to kill Lazarus too, for it was because of him that many of the people had deserted them and believed in Jesus. Let me pray. God, thanks for today, and thanks for this time of the year. Thanks for Christmas, and I pray that you would help us to remember and to know what it means to be people who understand the greatest gift that was ever given. I pray that Jesus would be our focus this Christmas. I pray that we would be able to engage really deeply on a heart, on a spirit level. The text this morning here, John 12, teach us from it. Make us more like you in the depths of who we are. I pray that you change us and that we would understand what it means to be the people that you've made us to be. Yeah, so thank you for all that you're doing in our lives. Thank you for who you are, and we worship you today. Thank you for coming and humbling yourself and being laid in a manger. And thank you for being born in a stable. And for all that was surrounding that, I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. Next slide. The point of John's gospel, right? The point of John's gospel is that people may believe that Jesus is who he claims to be, and by putting their faith in him, have life. That's the whole point, right? That's the whole point. It's important to unpack two key words in there, faith and life. Faith isn't something in the past. Life isn't something in the future. John thinks about both these things right now. All right, second, next slide, please. John wants you to know Jesus, not know about Jesus. The other three gospel writers wrote significantly more early than John did. John writes significantly later. And there's something in my brain, my imagination that just says, I mean, I think John read those gospels and was like, yeah, Matthew, Mark, Luke, great job. You know, well done. But you missed some stuff because you didn't know Jesus like I knew Jesus. And so he wrote the gospel of John. And John wants you to know Jesus, not know about Jesus. Next slide. Jesus in John 12 has to be linked to Jesus in John 11. Now, if you remember, last week we talked about resurrection and life. We talked about this guy Lazarus who had died. And word comes to Jesus and it says, your friend Lazarus is sick. And Jesus purposefully stays where he is for two more days. He doesn't get up, he doesn't run to help him, anything like that. He stays right where he is for two more days. Then he says, all right, let's go. Let's go see what's going on. And the disciples are like, why are we going to go back to Judea? They're going to try and kill you there. He says, look, Lazarus is asleep. And the disciples say, if he's asleep, let him rest. Jesus, Lazarus is dead. All right, Lazarus is dead. We're going to go back, and you're going to see God's glory revealed, is what he tells them. So they go back. He has this exchange with Mary and Martha. They're at the tomb. All the mourners are there. Jesus is filled with indignation. He's deeply troubled. He is angry in his spirit that this is not the way things were supposed to be. And he commands Lazarus to come back from the dead in front of a whole troop of people. Just a lot of people saw this miracle. Now, one of the strange places in Lebanon, in my mind, is on Chestnut Street at Chestnut and Lincoln. I drive by it every day. You know, it's like houses, houses, row homes, houses, houses, row homes, cemetery. You know, houses, 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 park, you know, Turkey Hill, that kind of stuff. Who put a cemetery at Chestnut and Lincoln? And this is, must be a really old school cemetery. Because I can't imagine that city planners would like that. But once you have a cemetery, once you have people in the ground, you know, there's not a lot you can do about that. There's a lot of people that care about those people that were buried there, you know, so you can't just go, you know, exhuming a cemetery or anything like that, or else you get yourself in a lot of hot water. I drive by Chestnut and Lincoln every day, right? I have never seen anyone attempting to raise anyone from the dead. I believe the Bible. I believe that God grants me all power and all authority. I'm not going to take you there and say, watch this, you know, which are the famous last words of any West Virginian, by the way. Watch this. I went to school in West Virginia. Hey, you want to hear another one? Did you guys hear at the governor's mansion in West Virginia burned down? Yeah, all the way to the axles. All right, so it's good stuff. All right, sorry if you're here from West Virginia. No offense, it was a great place, great place. I enjoyed my time there. All right, so anyway, what was I talking about? Cemeteries, yes, dead people. All right, so I would not take you there to say, okay, watch what I'm about to do, you know, and suddenly, you know, bring someone out of the ground. If I did, what would your response be? You know, it would just be like a whole, I'd be famous really quick, you know. People would know that. The word would spread, right? The name would get out. Jesus raises, and Jesus has done a lot of crazy stuff up to this point. He did raise someone else from the dead, a little girl. Her dad's name was Jairus. She was raised from the dead by Jesus, but Jesus told everyone there to keep it quiet. He said, you know, don't go around telling people about this. Jesus had made a blind guy see with spit mud, you know, he had made lame people walk, he had cast demons out. But to bring someone back from the dead, that's wild. So all of Judea is in an uproar about this. I mean, a good uproar. Jesus is as popular and as wonderful as he has ever been. He's also more threatening than he's ever been to the religious establishment that's around him. And that's where we pick up the story in John chapter 12, all right, in that kind of a scene. Jesus is as high up as he has ever been in the minds of the people, having brought Lazarus back from the dead. It would be the same thing if it was in our day, but there's still a serious threat to the people that are there. Not only that, but there's a misunderstanding that's taking place from the people who are around him. There's a reason why Christmas doesn't make sense to me, you know what I mean? Because it's so glorified and so romanticized. It's hard for me to think, and it's important to think of this and to realize that Jesus, with all this celebrity and all of this fame and all this stuff, this is a baby that was born in a manger, you know? The design was not for him to come with all this pomp and circumstance. His whole time here, he's saying, look, you guys like me now, but you haven't heard the hard stuff yet. Here's the hard stuff. I'm the bread of life. You got to eat my body and drink my blood. And then everybody walks away from him. But then he does other really cool stuff, like raising dead people and bringing them back to life. And everybody's back on the Jesus bandwagon. And Jesus is saying, look, I'm not going to be here much longer. And the disciples are walking around. This is amazing. We're his disciples. We're his followers. When he becomes powerful, we're going to be able to be powerful with him. Who else is he going to have as his advisors, as his advisors, except for us? You know, people are not listening to Jesus in the way that they need to. They're misunderstanding why he came. Jesus still knows and is continuing to say, look, I'm not going to be here much longer. I'm going to die. All right, I'm going to go away. And you're going to be without me. I'm going to suffer. You know, he's saying this throughout all the Gospels. And they're misunderstanding. They're not picking up on it. All right, so that's where we are at in John 12, 1. Okay? There, that's done. Okay. Christmas. How many of you have been insanely busy? I mean, just had a lot going on, you know? A lot going on. Yeah, a lot going on. Christmas, strangely enough, is a time when there's peace on earth and goodwill toward men, right? You go to a mall last night, I'll guarantee you, you're not going to see a lot of peace on earth and goodwill toward men. You know, you see old ladies beating up other people, you know? I mean, in order to get to that one thing, it's crazy. People, it's you know, people can become violent. Road rage, you know. I mean, traffic. I had to drive down through Lancaster on Friday night for a birthday party. It was raining on Friday night before Christmas. Driving down 222 down through Lancaster. Oh my goodness. No, I mean it was insane. It was insane. All these people were turning into Park City. I'm just thinking, gosh, I am so glad that I am not going there. Christmas is a time of insanity, right? And Christmas can become a time that becomes about the aspect of doing Christmas. And we can get really burnt out on doing Christmas. And by doing so, we lose the spirit of what Christmas is really meant to be. Right? Okay, awesome. Leave that there. All right, so we've got setting, we've got the fact that things change for us when we're so busy doing Christmas that we forget why Christmas is. All right? Okay, John 12, verse 1. 6 days before the Passover ceremonies began, Jesus arrived in Bethany. All right, now this is Jesus' last week of his life. And this is it here. We're winding up to the end. Jesus arrived in Bethany, the home of Lazarus, the man that he had raised from the dead. A dinner was prepared in Jesus' honor. Martha served, and Lazarus sat at the table with him. Then Mary took a 12-ounce jar of expensive perfume made from the essence of nard, and she anointed Jesus' feet with it and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with fragrance. Well, you know, let's continue before. But Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, the one who would betray him, said, "The perfume was worth a small fortune. It should have been sold and the money given to the poor." Not that he cared for the poor. He was a thief who was in charge of the disciples' funds, and he took some for his own use. Jesus said, "Leave her alone. She did it in preparation for my burial. You will always have the poor among you, but I will not be here with you much longer." When we read this story, it's easy to look at this. It's like, hey, that's cool. It's really neat that Mary did that for Jesus. That misses everything if we go there, all right? It's 6 days before the Passover. Passover is party time. It's a time when they remember the deliverance from Egypt. They come to Bethany, the home of Lazarus, the man that Jesus raised from the dead, and they're going to have a dinner. I don't know if it's in Lazarus' honor, if it's in Jesus' honor. The point is that they're all together for this meal. And everybody knows Jesus is there. You know, there's people crowding. The house, I mean, people are following Jesus everywhere he goes because Lazarus just came back from the dead. So a dinner was prepared in Jesus' honor. I love the next two words. Here's a quick rabbit trail. I love the next two words. Martha served. you know, now here's Martha where she belongs. You know, Jesus had before said to Martha, Martha, stop working, come be in my presence. You know, here Martha's released. It must have been great for Martha to be able to, like, do this meal. Martha and Lazarus sat at the table with him. So Lazarus is there. The formerly dead dude is there, which has just got to be a strange experience. You know, to have somebody be gone and to have come to, you know, to start to mourn and come to grips with that, and then you're back hanging out with them again. Wild. Jesus is awesome. Then Mary took a 12-ounce jar of expensive perfume made from the essence of nard, and she anointed Jesus' feet with it and wiped his feet with her hair, and the house was filled with fragrance. How many of you women here have perfume? You know, you have perfume at home. All right, you have perfume at home. When you buy perfume, right, does it come like in a pound bottle? Not usually. It comes in ounces, right? You buy little things of perfume. You know, little spray things. There's always, you know, those little things with the bulbs on the end. If I was a girl, I'd use those because they look more elegant. Perfume. You're talking almost a pound of perfume here. I mean, you buy perfume in ounces. 2 ounces will last you a really long time. Here's a pound of perfume. Right? 12 full ounces, 12 to 16 ounces of nard. Nard is stinky stuff. I mean, it's like this heavy, like musky odor. It was very big in Middle Eastern culture, still is. But nard, you know, it's not. It is strong, right? If somebody's wearing nard, you're gonna know it. And it also, nard is, I'm not enough on my perfume. I even tried to research this. I didn't get anywhere. I don't know what like really wealthy women would wear for perfume, but it would be that. And they would wear nard just to show, hey, I've got the money to wear nard. You know what I mean? So it's a status thing as much as anything. Mark tells us that this perfume cost a year's wages. Average American salary is $40,000. This is $40,000 perfume. Holy cow. Where's the stewardship moment now? I mean, my goodness. $40,000 perfume. A pound of it. This is the kind of thing that you set aside. You use it for very special occasions. This is an heirloom. You know, this would be passed down from mother to daughter to mother to daughter. I mean, you treasure this stuff. It's ridiculously expensive. It's incredibly fragrant. Mary, remember that misunderstanding concept that we talked about? That people are really missing Jesus' point? Mary might be the only person in the Gospels who actually understood what Jesus was talking about. Who really, when Jesus said, I'm going to have to die, she understood that that meant that he was going to die. And so what does she do? Well, she comes and the Bible tells us in another, again in Mark, that this thing is actually contained in an alabaster box. She breaks the alabaster box. A full pound of nard spills out over Jesus' feet. And Mark tells us that she anointed his head as well. And I mean, that fragrance would fill this entire room to the point that you would be sort of like, whoa. Man, that is really, there's a strong smell in here. You would, all of us in this room would know it if that were to happen. And they're in someone's dining room. And Mary comes in and breaks and spills out $40,000 worth of perfume and anoints Jesus' head. You'll hear sermons sometimes that talk a lot about that, about bringing Jesus your sacrifice, making sure you sacrifice everything. Good sermons, wonderful. That's not what I want to talk about today. I want to talk about this. Mary wiped Jesus' feet with her hair. Matthew talks about this, and it says that she also kissed his feet. Mary kissed Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair. This is a culture where men and women weren't allowed to eat together. Women would eat first, and then the men would sit down to eat. This is a culture where men and women sat on different sides of a synagogue. This is the kind of place that men and women, you didn't do this. This crossed significant, significant social boundaries. This broke all of the rules. This is a culture where women wear their hair up. A woman that wears her hair down is known to be a harlot in the town. No, Mary's not. This Mary we know. All right, so you don't need to think that. There's some legend that would tell you that. That's not true. This Mary is not a prostitute. What she does is she loves Jesus. And she breaks social customs, and she goes against the very grain of society. Why? Why does she do this? What did she just see? Here's Mary, a few days before, right, at Jesus' feet in the middle of a road, weeping her eyes out because her brother is dead. And she couldn't believe that Jesus, who could have stopped this, didn't. And so she's there, and she's disappointed, and she's hurt by him. He could have come. He could have stopped this. And he didn't. And she's weeping in the road. And he says, take me to the tomb. And what does he say? He says, Lazarus, come out. And he comes out. And what does that do for Mary? Did Jesus bail? No, not at all. Remember what we talked about last week? That there's an assumption in our minds that suffering means that God's not there. That if my life's not going the way that I think that it should, that God isn't active and present in it. And that is a lie. Those things and what we go through and the crap that we go through in our lives is because God wants to do something with that. He wants to bring glory from that. He wants to take death and he wants to bring it back to life. And Mary had just had her hopes dashed and wrecked by the one person that she knew could stop it because she assumed that Jesus didn't help. But he did, right? He didn't help the way that she expected. In fact, it was way bigger than what she expected. But Jesus showed up, and her disappointment was turned into the most full joy that any of us could ever possibly imagine. I'd like to tell you about a really dark night in my life. I don't remember what the night was. I don't remember what the date was. I didn't write it down in my journal. But it was very soon after Ben was born. Sorry, I just talked about this last week too, but there's people here that don't know me. We have two kids. We have three kids, two youngest with cystic fibrosis, all right? Christy, it's a genetic disease, right? You can figure out that through amniocentesis whether or not a baby's going to have cystic fibrosis. Christy had CF. Sherry and I decided not to have any more kids, you know, after Christy. We decided, look, we have one kid with CF. If we get pregnant again, there's a 25% chance that baby would have CF, and that would be, at that point, we thought that would be more than we could handle, you know. So we found out in July that Christy had CF, and then we found out in July 02, and then February 03, Sherry walked into the living room, and she was holding a pregnancy test, and she was crying, you know. It was just like, I'm pregnant again. And I was just like, whoa. You know, it was one of those weird times when you should be like jumping up and down and, you know, joyful. And it's just sort of like, well, there's this other piece of the puzzle thrown into it. We decided to have an amniocentesis. We were going to have it in June. That night or that in June, I felt like I got a word from the Lord that just said, look, Ben's not going to have CF. I heard it so strongly and believed it so clearly that I said to Sherry, you know, we don't need to do this thing. We don't need to do an amnio. I still tried to live in the reality of it, of the fact that, okay, here's this baby that's going to come into the world. There's a 25% chance that he's going to have CF. There's a 75% chance that he won't. And I think I heard from God on it. So, I mean, I was feeling relatively good about it. Without knowing it until it actually happened, right, there's this hope equilibrium that's taking place in the meantime of trying to live in the reality that this baby could have CF. So if he does, then, you know, then it won't just destroy me. Trying to, like, prepare myself for it. But there's this hope that's building on the inside that's just, before I even knew it, had just grown and grown and grown and grown that when this baby was born, he wasn't going to have CF. So Ben was born, and our doctor called in a favor, and we got fast blood work, and it turned out that Ben did have CF. We can talk another time about what it means to hear from God about stuff like that. That'd probably be a good conversation to have, but that's not for now. The bottom line is that sort of sent me into like this spiral, a downward. It sent us into this spiral downward, but it was because of me. Like our relationship suffered significantly because of the way in which I began to internalize that. So my pastor put me on a sabbatical, and we were going to counseling at the time. And I remember in counseling, I was a youth pastor at the time at Hope Church in St. Louis, Missouri. And in counseling, I was just saying to our counselor, her name was Diane, I was just saying, I cannot believe that how much that hurt, to have that much hope and then to have that taken away, to have that much hope and have that taken away. I said, I don't understand what I'm doing wrong. I don't understand what's going on here. I don't understand what more does God want from me than what I'm doing already, I'm a youth pastor. I'm pretty good at it. I enjoy it. The kingdom of God is being built. Students are growing up in Jesus. I'm learning to be a better leader. I'm faithful to my wife. I love my kids. I mean, what more does God want me to do than what I'm doing? What else is there? And she didn't give me any answers. Good counselor. What she did say was that you are going to have to wrestle with God. Now, I'm the kind of guy who's arrogant enough to think that if I did that, I might be able to win. So I took that as sort of like a challenge from her. I was just like, I need to wrestle. Jacob wrestled with God, and he got a new name. I forgot about the fact that he was also made lame in one leg. She said, you're going to have to wrestle. You're going to have to wrestle with God. Okay, all right, I can do that. I can do that. And so I decided to wrestle with God. And what wrestling meant was trying to prove to God that he needed to give me an answer, right? Trying to prove to him that there was a place that he wasn't meeting me and that he needs to give me an answer about this. And so I just started throwing myself back into work, got back into the work saddle. It didn't help. It didn't help my depression. It didn't help my relationship. It didn't help anything at all like that. There finally came one night when I was just ready to quit. Right? And by quit, I mean quit ministry. I was just like, you know what? Fine. If you don't want my service, I won't give it to you. Yeah, and like he needs it or something. Like there's not someone that could be a better youth pastor at Hope Church than me. And so I was just like, fine. And we went to counseling. I told Diane, I was like, look, I'm thinking about quitting. Sherry and I had this conversation. And she was saying, we didn't know what to do. Our lives were in such confusion. Diane said, have you wrestled with God yet? I was like, I've been wrestling the whole stinking time. She said, well, what has wrestling been like? And I was just like, I've been trying to serve. She's like, that's not wrestling. I come over here so I can slap you. That's not wrestling. That's not wrestling with God. She says, for you to wrestle with God means you have to remember who you are. Okay. So I was like, well, who am I? She's like, don't ask me that. I'm not God. You need to ask Jesus who you are. Now, that's an interesting thought, isn't it? That wrestling, when we're trying to be strong, I'm just trying to be like, tough guy Jay and try and push through this thing and, God, define me and help my hope and I can be strong enough to walk through this. That's not at all what I needed to do, right? I needed to be something. I just didn't know that. So she told me that. So that night, I decided to wrestle with God. I didn't have a clue what any of this meant, mind you. I didn't have any idea what I was getting myself into. All I knew was that I was angry. I knew I was angry, which is a perfectly fine place to start. So I went, I took my basketball, which is what I did when I was angry growing up. It's just what I've always done. I took my basketball. I took it up to the church gym. This is like 10 o'clock at night, right? And I told God that I was ready to do business with him. And so I started shooting hoops, and I started thinking about Ben, and I started thinking about Christy, and I started thinking about what their lives might be like in the future. And from a pain standpoint, not from like a redemptive standpoint at all. And man, I just got more and more angry as I did that. And I was all by myself. It's a relatively good thing I was. I think people would have thought I was insane. I just started like kicking the ball around the gym and started I was yelling at God, asking him what he was doing. I'm just bawling my eyes out, wanting to know what in the world is going on. Why can't you be pleased with me? That was the key, right? Why can't you be pleased with me? Enough to not let my kids have CF. So I ended up driving around North City St. Louis, which is not a nice place to be, North City St. Louis, in our car at like 2 or 3 a.m. I found myself ended up in a Denny's on Natural Bridge Road with my journal. And this is one of the defining times. I mean, Denny's of all places, like the greasiest restaurant in the world. You know, it was my place of redemption. I'm sitting in this booth, and I'm talking to Jesus. And here's what I wrote down. I don't even need my journal. This is how much I remember this. I said, Jesus, I can't please you enough. So I give up. Sorry. And he said, yes. He said, thank you. Thank you. Now I can help. The experience that night was really something, because what it took for me to get to that point of abandonment, you know, of being able to deal with my hopelessness, of being able to deal with my depression, it took me taking my alabaster box and breaking it. You know, I had to sacrifice the thing that was most important to me, which in my case was me. You know, I was most important to me. And I had to say, fine, I can't please you enough. You know, I give up. And it was then that I realized that God was my father more than he was my judge. I'd always thought that God was my judge, you know, but here God steps in, and it's a very merry experience for me. To break this, you know, to wreck this. And then to have Jesus bring some kind of healing and life into that. And what I learned in the experience was this. Is that Mary's not doing anything here. I mean, she is, sort of. You know, I mean, she's walking in, she's breaking this thing. But what she's doing is she is giving herself to Jesus. Outside of all the social restraints, outside of all the things that she had ever been taught, outside of all the things that her culture said, she's giving herself to him. She's giving him everything because she understands. She understands Jesus. She understands a key point here in that he's going to die and be buried, and as far as she knows, he's not going to come back, you know. But she's okay with that because she simply loves him because of what he did for her. She saw life at work in him. You know, she saw life take root in him. She saw life become a real thing, and he brought hope into her brokenness. And she comes and she gives herself to him fully and honors him. And she's doing, but she's not. She's not at all. She's loving Jesus. And Jesus receives it. And Mary can be at no more a beautiful a point than she is right now. And you can see by Jesus' response, Judas says, right? Judas, the one who was betraying him, says the exact same thing that any of us would. What a waste. 40 grand on one dude's feet. You know, you got to be joking. It would have been a more wise, practical investment to sell this money and to give that stuff to the poor, even though obviously John doesn't have a very high opinion of Judas, you know, because Judas was a thief, you know, and he would take stuff from him. But Judas has a perfectly relevant point, a point that any of us would have made as well, that this kind of extravagance is ridiculous. That kind of giving, that kind of sacrifice is absolutely ridiculous. And what does Jesus say? I love these three words. He says, leave her alone. You leave her alone. Why? Because she gets me. She understands me. She knows that I'm going to die and be buried. And she's preparing me for my burial. You get off her back. She's mine. And she's loving me. When the people heard of Jesus' arrival, right? They all flock. I mean, so everybody's seeing this. The leading priests, this religious establishment, they're all coming back after Jesus and trying to kill him. None of that matters at this point in time. There are two people in that room, in Jesus' mind, in Mary's mind, and that's Jesus and Mary and the extravagance of her worship. Next slide. The story of Mary and the perfume carries two very important aspects with it, all right? The first aspect, next slide, is there's an obvious act of giving, right? There's an obvious act of giving that takes place, and there is. You know, there's a point where that has to be sacrificed. But what we miss, and where I want to put the emphasis today, is, next slide, a not-so-obvious foundation for giving, which stems from receiving. That's the second aspect of what's going on here. Here's the point. And this is the whole story of Christmas. This is why we're here today. This is why we have Christmas Eve. This is why we have the malls. Why we do trees and lights and presents and all that sort of stuff. You've got to understand that Christmas is about the fact that God became a man. God became a human being and came down to earth. And that's the gift that matters. And the other gifts don't. God is the initiator in this relationship. He's the one that comes to you and I and says, I love you. We don't come to him and say, please accept me. He comes to us and says, you're mine. Stop running around like chickens with your heads cut off. Come, be at my feet. Love on me. Let me give you life. Look at what I've done for you. I am the greatest gift that you will ever know. And in this season of gift giving, we have got to understand that the only reason that we can give is because we have received. And a reception of God's love is so much more important than anything that we could ever do for him. And I tried to prove to God why it was that he should love me. And here's the story of Christmas, is there is no reason why God should love us, but he does. And he chooses us, not based on anything that we've done, not based on any merit of our own. And our acts for him are a response from that. I think that the church needs to stop telling people what to do and start telling people who they are. Because the more that we tell people what to do, and we don't base that in who people are, the more we simply feed people the lies of the religious leaders of those days, which is God will love you if. God will love you if. Doing is a place of action. Being is a place of identity. And Mary understands how to receive and then love. And most of us don't. Mary understands how to receive and then love, and most of us don't. A release of doing and a stepping into being brings the most incredible freedom that you can ever know. Because God is the initiator in this relationship, and he does not want our stuff. Right? He doesn't want all of these things that we bring to him and say, here you go. You know, we kill Christmas by getting busy. We kill the spirit of the season by letting the busyness overtake us and change us. That's not the point. That's not the point, right? The point is that here's this great festive time, wonderful, to be with family and to give gifts and to hang lights and to make gingerbread houses, you know? And these are all good things, you know? Santa Claus is a cool dude, you know, whatever. All nice stuff. But that can all get wiped out, right? When our need to get stuff done for Christmas, you know, turns us into these giant ogres, you know, or we're just trying to get to December 25th and we can't even enjoy December 25th because we're too tired from being an ogre. It's the same basic parallel. So many of us are marching around in our lives trying to be strong and trying to prove to God that he should love us and trying to do things that earn something for us when he just wants us. He just wants us. And on a level, when you get there, that will be, there will be a level of sacrifice. And there's a lot of people here today who come from a lot of different walks of life, and what that sacrifice is going to be different for all of us. There's some of you here today that have been running from God your whole life, and you know it. And right now, the Holy Spirit's going, hey, hello, you've heard this before. I've been saying to this for years. And you're thinking, when can I get out of here? You need to be here because you need to see Jesus for who he is. He loves you. He wants you, and he wants only you. And it's a stumbling stone. It's a rock of offense for us to come up against him and to say to Jesus, well, don't you want something in return? And for him to say, no. No. I just want you. And some of us here today have to lay our lives down for the first time and to say, look, I'm at the end of myself. Everything I keep trying is not working for me. And it's not because Jesus will work for me. It's because I need him. Because he's the greatest gift. Some of us here are running around in our religious lives, having a full relationship with Jesus, but not knowing who the heck he really is. And so we miss out on the Mary relationship. We miss out on the ability to really love him and to be defined by him just simply as sons and daughters. And nothing else, as the lover of our soul. Song of Solomon is a scandalous book. This is a scandalous act, right? This crosses serious lines. That's the love with which God loves you. That level, that depth, that desire. That's what he wants. That's what's happening here. There is such a deep exchange of love that is going so far to the core of who Mary is and who Jesus is. And that's what God is calling you and I to today. The question is, can you release? And that's a hard question. Because a release from doing brings an incredible amount of freedom, but it still does break the alabaster box, you know? It still does cost. But it is in that you will find life, and that you will find life abundant. And Jesus isn't this band-aid that heals all of your issues. But he is the one who brings joy, peace, meaning, beauty into worlds filled with ugliness and brokenness and horrific things that we've all gone through. And he takes those things back and he says, just be with me. Love on me. Let me love you. Let's have relationship. Let's get to know one another. But please stop running around. Whatever it takes for you to get to the end of yourself, get there. And when you get there, realize that he is sitting there gazing at you with these eyes that are so alive and so beautiful, just saying, you are mine and I love you for no other reason than that. Joy, you can get your team in place, please. The truth of Jesus' love for us is something that every one of us needs to know. The truth of who he is, right? The fullness of who he is and the freedom that he gives is what he wants to offer. This Christmas, he wants to give you the greatest gift that you've ever gotten, which is himself, for you to really understand what Christmas is. Don't allow Christmas and the reason for it to get pushed out. We have a great time with our families. It's wonderful traditions that we have. Put all those things aside just now for this moment and ask yourself this, what about Jesus? Where is he at in your picture? Well beyond Christmas. What's your relationship with him consist of? Everything that we desire is based on our need for and desire for love and to truly be loved. And he alone can love us like we really need. Whatever empty part of you there might be, whatever lack of peace, joy, hope, all those things, understand that you can find these things in Jesus. That's the reason for Christmas. The most unspeakable gift came down and was laid as a little baby in a manger so that you and I could truly understand what it means to live. So are you alive this Christmas? Let's stand. So may you, my brothers and sisters at Cornerstone, may you be filled with all of the fullness and the depth and the wonder of God's huge, incredible love for you this Christmas. And may you truly receive it. Amen. Amen. Tonight o'clock, 7 o'clock. If you can't come back tonight, have a great Christmas with your families. Thanks for coming. God bless.